Welcome to the World of Woodhouse, a series of podcasts from the P.G. Woodhouse Society, UK, to commemorate the work of P.G. Woodhouse on the occasion of the 50th anniversary of his death. I'm Alexander Armstrong, and I have the huge privilege of being president of the P.G. Woodhouse Society, UK, a literary society of enthusiasts that celebrates Woodhouse and his work. And it is my delightful duty to introduce the latest guest in this series of podcasts.
Hello, I'm Neil Pearson. I'm a patron of the P.G. Woodhouse Society and, like you, a devoted fan of all things Woodhouse. Like all such devotees, which is to say all those of sound mind, I find his books endlessly, joyously rereadable. And why wouldn't you? Woodhouse was a comic genius and a peerless stylist. But I also find Woodhouse endlessly rereadable because I can never remember which ones I've read. There are the Jeeves ones, the Blandings ones, the Smith ones, the Mulliner ones, all of which narrows it down a bit. But in my mind, every Woodhouse book features butlers and pigs and cow creamers and flower pots and daffy girls and terrifying aunts and brainless young dandies and mad old aristocrats. And when I pick up a Woodhouse, I expect to encounter all of them all at once. And when I put the book down again, I always feel that I have, and that the book, which contains the whole Woodhouse universe, has just been temporarily set aside to be finished later. Which it never is. Which is all well and good until someone asks you, as the Society has just asked me, to pick a favourite Woodhouse title and read a passage into this microphone. I knew immediately the passage I wanted to read. I was sure it was from a short story, certain it was comparatively unsung but absolutely top-drawer Woodhouse, that it was set in a nightclub where our romantic leads are dining. A disagreement turns into a skirmish, the skirmish turns into a fight, and the fight quickly engulfs the entire room. Food flies, diners are spattered, and phalanxes of waiters are deployed to subdue the uprising. Now, all I had to do was locate it. For reasons I hope are now clear, I had no clue where to find it, and although the search was enjoyable, it was also fruitless. But it's during crises like this one that the P.G. Woodhouse Society really comes into its own, and I'd like to thank Nick Townend, the Society's resident Woodhouse encyclopedia, for pointing me in the right direction. The passage I was looking for comes not from a short story, but from a novel, Summer Lightning, first published in the United States with the title Fish Preferred. It is not comparatively unsung. It's the third Blandings novel. It was published in 1929, filmed in 1933, and has been adapted for radio and the stage on a pretty regular basis ever since it was published. Oh, and it's not set in a nightclub. It's set in a restaurant. But apart from that, I was spot on. And I was right about one thing. It is absolutely top drawer Woodhouse. The scene is simply set. Ronnie Fish loves Sue Brown. Sue Brown's feelings for Ronnie Fish are, at this stage in the novel, less clear-cut. Ronnie has attempted to visit Sue at her home, only to be told by Bashford, the porter, that she is dining at Mario's. Bashford is unable to furnish Ronnie with the name of Sue's companion for the evening, and Ronnie sets off for Mario's, hoping against hope that Sue's chaperone will turn out to be Hugo Carmody, who, being safely engaged to someone else, poses no threat to Ronnie's future happiness. But fearing very much that disaster is about to strike and that he is about to come face to face with Percy Pilbeam. Jealousy, said Shakespeare, and he was about right, is the green-eyed monster which doth mock the meat he feeds on. By the time Ronald Overbury Fish pushed through the swinging door that guards the revelry at Mario's from the gaze of the passer-by, he was, like the Othello he so much resembled, perplexed in the extreme. He felt hot all over, then cold all over, then hot again. And the waiter who stopped him on the threshold of the dining room to inform him that evening dress was indispensable on the dancing floor and that flannel suits must go up to the balcony was running a risk which would have caused his insurance company to purse its lips and shake its head. Fortunately for him, Ronnie did not hear. He was scanning the crowd before him in an effort to find Sue. Plenty of room in the balcony, sir, urged the waiter, continuing to play with fire. This time Ronnie did become dimly aware that somebody was addressing him, and he was about to turn and give the man one look, when halfway down a grove of black coats and gaily coloured frocks, he suddenly saw what he was searching for. The next moment he was pushing a path through the throng, treading on the toes of brave men and causing fair women to murmur bitterly that this sort of thing ought to be prevented by the management. 5 yards from Sue's table, Ronnie Fish would have said that his cup was full and could not possibly be made any fuller. But when he had covered another 2 and pushed aside a fat man who was standing in the fairway, he realised his mistake. It was not Hugo who was Sue's companion, but a reptilian-looking squirt with narrow eyes and his hair done in ridges. And as he saw him, something seemed to go off in Ronnie's brain like a released spring. A waiter, pausing with a tray of glasses, pointed out to him that on the dancing floor, evening dress was indispensable. Gentlemen in flannel suits, he added, could be accommodated in the balcony. Plenty of room in the balcony, sir, said the waiter. Ronnie reached the table. Pilbeam, at that moment, was saying that he had wanted for a long time to meet Sue. He hoped she had got his flowers all right. It was perhaps a natural desire to look at anything but this odious and thrusting individual who had forced his society upon her that caused Sue to raise her eyes. Raising them, she met Ronnie's. And as she saw him, her conscience, which she had supposed lulled for the night, sprang to life more vociferous than ever. It had but been crouching, the better to spring. Ronnie! She started up. Pilbeam also rose. The waiter with the glasses pressed the edge of his tray against Ronnie's elbow in a firm but respectful manner, and told him that on the dancing floor evening dress was indispensable. Gentlemen in flannel suits, however, would find ample accommodation in the balcony. Ronnie did not speak, and it would have been better if Sue had not done so, for at this crisis some subconscious instinct of the kind which is always waiting to undo us at critical moments suggested to her dazed mind that when 2 men who do not know each other are standing side by side in a restaurant, one ought to introduce them. "Mr. Fish, Mr. Pilbeam," murmured Sue. Only the ringing of the bell that heralds the first round of a heavyweight championship fight could have produced more instant and violent results. Through Ronnie's flannel-clad body, a sort of galvanic shock seemed to pass. Pilbeam. He had come expecting Hugo, and Hugo would have been bad enough, but Pilbeam! The man she had said she didn't even know, the man she hadn't met, the man whose gifts of flowers she had professed to resent, in person, in the flesh, hobnobbing with her in a restaurant. "By gad," he meant to say, "by George, good gosh!" His fists clenched. Eton was forgotten, Cambridge not even a memory. He inhaled so sharply that a man at the next table who was eating a mousse of chicken stabbed himself in the chin with his fork. He turned on Pilbeam with a hungry look, and at this moment the waiter, raising his voice a little, for he was beginning to think that Ronnie's hearing was slightly affected, mentioned as an interesting piece of information that the management of Mario's preferred to reserve the dancing floor exclusively for clients in evening dress. But there was a bright side. Gentlemen in flannel suits could be accommodated in the balcony. It was the waiter who saved Percy Pilbeam. Just as a mosquito may divert for an instant a hunter who is about to spring at and bite in the neck a tiger of the jungle, so did this importunate waiter divert Ronnie Fish. What it was all about he was too overwrought to ascertain, but he knew that the man was annoying him, pestering him, trying to chat with him when he had business elsewhere. With all the force of a generous nature sorely tried,
He plugged the waiter in the stomach with his elbow. There was a crash which even Leopold's band could not drown. The man who had stabbed himself with the fork had his meal still further spoiled by the fact that it suddenly began to rain glass. And as regards the other occupants of the restaurant, the word sensation about sums the situation up. Ronnie and the management of Mario's now formed two sharply contrasted schools of thought. To Ronnie, the only thing that seemed to matter was this pillbeam, this creeping, slinking, cuckoo-in-the-nest pillbeam, the Lothario who had lowered all speed records in underhand villainy by breaking up his home before he had got one. He concentrated all his faculties to the task of getting round the table, to the other side of which the object of his dislike had prudently withdrawn, and showing him in no uncertain manner where he got off. To the management, on the other hand, the vital issue was all this broken glassware. The waiter had risen from the floor, but the glasses were still there, and scarcely one of them was in a condition ever to be used again for the refreshment of Mario's customers. The head waiter, swooping down on the fray like some god in the Iliad descending from a cloud, was endeavouring to place this point of view before Ronnie. Assisting him with word and gesture were two inferior waiters, Waiter A and Waiter B. Ronnie was in no mood for abstract debate. He hit the head waiter in the abdomen, Waiter A in the ribs, and was just about to dispose of Waiter B when his activities were hampered by the sudden arrival of reinforcements. From all parts of the room, other waiters had assembled, to name but a few, Waiters C, D, E, F, G, and H, and he found himself hard-pressed. It seemed to him that he had dropped into a waiter's convention. As far as the eye could reach, the arena was crammed with waiters and more coming. Pillbeam had disappeared altogether, and so busy was Ronnie now that he did not even miss him. He had reached that condition of mind which the old Vikings used to call berserk, and which among modern Malays is termed running amok. Ronnie Fish, in the course of his life, had had many ambitions. As a child, he had yearned some day to become an engine driver. At school, it had seemed to him that the most attractive career the world had to offer was that of the professional cricketer. Later, he had hoped to run a prosperous nightclub, but now, in his 26th year, all these desires were cast aside and forgotten. The only thing in life that seemed really worthwhile was to massacre waiters. And to this task, he addressed himself with all the energy and strength at his disposal. Matters now began to move briskly. Waiter C, who rashly clutched the sleeve of Ronnie's coat, reeled back with a hand pressed to his right eye. Waiter D, a married man, contented himself with standing on the outskirts and talking Italian. But Waiter E, made of sterner stuff, hit Ronnie rather hard with a dish containing omelette or champignon, and it was as the latter reeled beneath this buffet that there suddenly appeared in the forefront of the battle a figure wearing a gay uniform and almost completely concealed behind a vast moustache waxed at the ends. It was the commissionaire from the street door, and anybody who has ever been bounced from a restaurant knows that commissionaires are heavy metal. This one, whose name was McTeague, and who had spent many lively years in the army before retiring to take up his present duties, had a grim face made of some hard kind of wood and the muscles of a village blacksmith. A man of action rather than words, he clove his way through the press in silence. Only when he reached the centre of the maelstrom did he speak. This was when Ronnie, leaping upon a chair the better to perform the operation, hit him on the nose. On receipt of this blow, he uttered the brief monosyllable "Oop!" and then, without more delay, scooped Ronnie into an embrace of steel and bore him towards the door, through which was now moving a long, large, leisurely policeman. When the book is by Woodhouse, it's not just that book you're entering, but a whole world. What Evelyn Waugh called a world for us to live in and delight in.